Hey, thanks.
Wild at the rooster.
Good.
Shimmy, we didn't wear Shimmy teachers knowing that not feel me until.
Right, so I'll have to work it out with him. Yeah, remind me to. He's usually very accommodating.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see. We were learning on Daf Yudalid Omen Aleph. And let's see. Yeah, we're up to Ki Samchuha L'Rabbi Ami L'Rav Asi. And the Gemara is telling us various songs that they sang when various Chachamim received Smicha. And in this case, Sharalei Hachi. This is the content of the song that they sang. Kol min dein, smochu lanu. Kol shehem kmo elu, kol shehem kmo elu. Anyone who's like these, they should be given svicha. Meaning these are paradigms, these are personifications of a personality of someone who's got all the chachma, all the wisdom, all the inner qualities and attributes to be conferred with smicha. But if someone is not like them, lo tismichu lanu, please don't bestow smicha upon the following. And now in the list that now comes down the line, we're going to have sarmitin, sarmisin, and chamisin and turmisin. Actually, there are four different descriptions or categories listed here in the Gemara. These are all negative categories. Now, with the exception of Turmisin, which is the last one on the list, the first three are very, very similar. And there's a common thread that underlies all three. It's very hard to differentiate between one and the other. So let me give, by way of introduction, what I call the general description that underlies all these three categories and why they should be rejected for smicha. There are two ways a person could go about studying the Torah and teaching the Torah and paskening shilas based on the Torah. One is simply to grasp, if you will, the mechanics, the laws, the regulations, the rules. It's like memorizing a law text. And in such a case, although you may have a great deal of knowledge and you may fool us into thinking that you deserve smicha, but the problem is that you don't seem to have a deeper grasp of the subject matter. So take, for example, the case of sarmitin. Sarmitin, Rashi says, are people who einam nosnin tam l'divrayim. They don't give any explanation for what they say. So they give you a hardcore rule, and they tell you what the law is, but they don't explain the law. And we're going to see something similar, if we fast forward for a moment, in the case of chamisim, because chamisim are those who are monim, they inhibit themselves, they pull back milomar from explaining tamei haTorah, the reasons for the Torah.
Do they know it? And they pull back?
So that might be the difference, perhaps, between the first category and the third category, between sarmitim and chamisim. It could be chamisim on a higher level. These are individuals who know the tamei haTorah. They understand the logic that underlies the halacha, but they refuse, for whatever reason, to share it with us. In a sense, they're like selfish. The first category, which is called sarmitin, who are people who don't give any reason, it's very possible that these are people who really don't understand the Torah itself. They may memorize it and they can spit it back, but they don't understand it. Rashi tells us that sarmitim is miloshen smartut. Smatud is a very negative kind of a word. It's like a rag kind of thing. It's something that you use to clean up rubbish on the floor. Well, that's because they really haven't gotten to that level of knowledge. Now, it could be that when we get to Chamisim are people who may have that grasp. They have an understanding and grasp of the inner meanings of the Torah, but they refuse for some reason to share it with us. So Rashi asks, well, what is the Shoresh, what is the root of the word Chamisim? In the case of Sarmitin, Rashi says the root of the word is Smartut, which is a low rag, meaning it's not really on a high level. But in the case of Chamisim, Rashi identifies the word Chamisim with Chamsanim. Now, Chamsanim is a kind of a thief. It's a thief who doesn't necessarily outright steal from you. He does it in a very subtle way. He grabs something of yours and he says, well, I'm buying it from you. And he puts the money on the table. You have no interest in selling it to him. So here also, he's giving the Torah, but he's really stealing the Torah. Why? Because he's not giving the people any sort of an insight into the underlying logic of the mechanics of it. He's just simply stating the facts on the ground, but he refuses to share with them the insights. And that's how I understand Rashi in the case of Chamisim. Now, Rashi adds something else over here. He says that Chamisim is also Miloshen Chomesh. This is not Rashi here, but Rashi Masechet Ksubos. Chomesh means 20%. And that means they give us 20% of what we have to know. They're very stingy about what they... you could have people who are reserved, and you could have people who are very outgoing and talkative, and you could have people of the Benin right in the middle. But even a person who's reserved, hopefully, you may have to pull teeth out of it, but he'll eventually say what he has to say. He'll reveal to you what he has to reveal to you. You'll get an appreciation for what he's telling you, what he's transmitting to you. In the case of Chamisim, you just can't pull the teeth. They won't share it with you. They're holding it back. They're keeping their cards close to their chest. And what you end up with is about 20% of the understanding of the Torah. So what I'd like to suggest here is both in the case of Sarmitim and as well in the case of Chamisim, the transmission of the Torah becomes very placid, very superficial. And people who receive the Torah in these cases will not appreciate the Torah. They don't appreciate the glory, the beauty of the Torah, the complexity of the Torah, because all they're getting is very superficial rules and regulations. Just dry cut mechanical laws and rules. But I want to go even beyond that, and I want to suggest the following, that if I just give you a rule, you'll never really understand how and when to apply the rule. Life is it's infinite. All the situations are myriads of situations that are infinite. No two situations are exactly alike. They're not identical. When you give someone a rule without explaining the rule, and the person who receives it doesn't comprehend the underlying logic of the rule, then he doesn't have any clue how to apply it. So he doesn't differentiate between one case and the other. But if you give him the tameh halachos, if you give him the Torah with its tameh, then and only then is he able to apply it in the proper way. Now, in the middle between these two cases of Sarmitim and Chamisim, we have someone who's called Sarmisim. And Sarmisim is perhaps the worst of them all, because Rashi says that Sarmisim is Miloshon Sirus. Sirus is when you change something from one extreme to the other. No, it's the meaning, you take it and you completely, what's the word I'm looking for, to when you vilify them, change the meaning of something from one extreme to the other. What word can I use? Anybody? To corrupt. Excellent. Corrupt. So these are those who corrupt the meaning of the Torah. In other words, they will give you explanations, but they don't really understand the Torah themselves, so they, in effect, what they're doing is corrupting the meaning of the Torah. That's called sirus. For example, the word sirus applies when you have a dog that's able to get pregnant and she has many puppies, so you do sirus. Once again, I'm looking for the word. What's it called when you take a dog and you...
You
neuter it? Is that the word?
Yeah,
to neuter
it?
Spade it, right? You neuter it. That's called the saris, to make sure that it won't have children. So, you know, the essence of the dog is to have puppies, and now you make it... That's called sirus.
Are these people ignorant or just willfully corrupting? Are they just...
Well, again, in the first case, I think they're ignorant. The first case was that he's on such a low level, like a smartud, that he really doesn't understand the Torah. He's just been memorizing its laws. You know, he can spit back. I don't know if you ever had this in college, where you take an exam, and if I would ask you 5 minutes after you finish the exam, you would get a zero on it, because you were able to cram it up until the... So you really didn't understand that what you were saying, but you were able to spit it back. When I was in graduate school, I took a course in phenomenology, and the professor was from France. And my faculty advisor, I still remember his name, this is 40 years ago and more, Bill McKenna, he said, "You got to take this course." I said, "Bill, I have no background in phenomenology." He says, "Don't worry, this guy came from France, this is a very special treat." If I tell you, Rabosa, I would not be exaggerating, that the only reason I passed the course, and I did pretty well in graduate school, is because he allowed us to photocopy his typewritten notes. I took 250 pages of typewritten notes, and I locked myself up in a room for 3 weeks. I didn't see the light of day, and I got a B+ in the course, only because I was able to spit back 250 pages of notes. I didn't understand the thing. So that's the level of what we call sarmitin. Chamisim is not someone who deliberately corrupts the meaning, but he refuses to share with you the meaning. You know, he holds himself. You know, we say Yisha Halzach and Grayson. You know, he holds himself to be, you know, with his nose up in the air, so he doesn't want to lower himself to your level to have to explain it to you. Or maybe he's just a very tight, you know, tight mouthed guy, so he doesn't share with you. The middle case, though, the way Rashi interprets Sarmisim on the Mesarsim, there you might be tempted to say, I can't convince myself, but maybe they deliberately are corrupting the meaning of the Torah. Now, and the reason why I'm very, very very hesitant to accept that pshat, I don't think that's what Rashi means, is because how could this person be a candidate for smicha? I mean, like, who's, you know, talk about smicha, ish vipi ish, going back to Moshe Rabbeinu. And you're telling me this guy deliberately corrupts the Torah, the meaning of the Torah, that's really hard to believe. How did he get so far? You know what I mean? But the truth is that I'm going to have to face the music here, because let's look at the fourth category. The fourth category is Turmisin. Now, Turmisim, Rashi identifies as Reikanim. These are people who are empty. And usually when you talk about an Ish Reik, you mean that as far as Midos are concerned, as far as morality and ethics, he's an empty person. And it's very hard for me to believe that this guy went so far as he, you know, he's topping his class for Smicha, you know? That we have to sing about the fact that Rav Ami and Rav Asi are not Turmisim, you know, they're not Anoshim Reikim, Reikonim. Very, very strange. But I have a footnote here in which he quotes the Aruch. I don't know if you ever heard of the Aruch. He lived at the end of the period of the Gaonim, before the period of the Rishonim. His name is Rabbi Nosson. So he adds two very important points to this whole song here that we're learning about. He claims that Sarmisim, which if you remember, Sarmisim, Rashi identified as those who corrupt the meaning of the Torah. He says that the word Sarmisim is an acronym for a chut hatvia kshachutim mistabchim zebozeh. What it means is the following: that in the process of preparing string, what happens is they take smaller strings and they weave them together. So every string is made up of really a number of smaller strings. That's called tvia. And what the sarmisim are guilty of is they never actually separate these threads. So what you end up with is mistavchim zebazeh. It's all intertwined. It's like if you've ever gone out and you see a bush, and sometimes all the branches are twisted, they're connected one to the other, and they're intertwined. That's called mistavchim zebazeh. So it seems to me that what the Aruch wants to accomplish here by reinterpreting sarmisim, instead of someone who deliberately corrupts the meaning of the Torah, that far we're not going to go, but we're going to talk about sarmisim as those who complicate the Torah. Instead of simplifying the Torah, they complicate it. Now, I hope you want to answer yes to this question, but have you ever gone to a shir and you thought you understood it clearly before you came into the shir, and you walked out of the shir and everything was totally mishkabal, you were so confused? Hopefully, I'm not guilty of that. If I am, then according to the Aruch, my name tag would say I'm one of the sarmisim. I'm one of those who take the chutei tviya and mistabchim sevazeh. You understand less when you leave the shir than when you did when you entered the shir. My Rebbe Zichron Levracha was just the opposite. It was an amazing experience. I learned with one of the brightest guys on the face of the earth. He was my chavrus, Alan Dubin. And when we prepared for the Shia, sometimes it was like total confusion. We couldn't figure out. There were so many elements to the sugya, and they were all intertwined. We couldn't make any seder out of it, any order out of it. And then we came into the Rav Shia, and all of a sudden, like, everything fit into place. It was like a puzzle where each piece was in its place. It was amazing. So these sarmisim, according to the Aruch, are those who are mesabchim. They give us complicated, ambiguous understanding. Then he says that sarmitim, which, if you recall, Rashi put sarmitim on a very low level, comparing them to a smartut, is really an acronym. It's a kinui, liksav mekulkol she'eno borer lekriya. In other words, if, let's say, for example, you have a page, a printed page, and some ink spills on it, or even water spills on it, everything gets smudged, and you can no longer clearly see the words on the page. And this person, although he is able to separate the threads, as we said, and maybe categorize and organize the various elements in the sugya, but at the end, when it comes to kriya means that after you go through an entire painstaking effort to try to understand something, at the end you want to end up with a kriya, that everything you learned, you could read it back into the original text. He doesn't have that ability, that canny, that that great pedagogic tool of not only you walking out at the end of a long investigation with clarity, but to bring that clarity back to the original text and being able to understand it and read the text. Then the text becomes a great method of review, because everything is clear in the text. And probably this is a mashal for what we call Torah Shebaksav and Torah Shebaalpeh, meaning that ultimately, after you receive and understand and appreciate the Torah Shebaalpeh, now you can go back to the Torah Shebaksav. And when you read the written Torah, now everything becomes absolutely meaningful. Like they say, I don't know if it's true, that Rabbi Aaron Kotler very often used to ask Mechila from the Baal Kore, because very often he would stop the Baal Kore and ask him to repeat. Why? Because as soon as he heard a pasuk, he started thinking about all the words of Chazal, and he missed the next pasuk because he was so involved in the first pasuk. He couldn't hear it on a superficial level, just translate the words. So very often he would ask the Baal Kore to repeat the words. I don't know if it's a true story, but anyway, it's a legend. Now the Aruch talks about the word. Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
Just a question. When people are going for smicha, Like, I know today people study very hard and they pass a test, and when we're in the days we're talking about, were they also studying, or did the rabbi who wanted to give smicha just say, he's a good candidate, I'm giving him smicha?
No. He would test him. He would have to make sure that he was on a very high level, not only in potential, but he had actualized that potential. And what we're learning now, according to the Aruch, and maybe even according to Rashi, is that to get smicha means that you're part of the transmission of Torah. You're a Rebbe, and now you should be teaching Torah to others. And even if you have balabatim who are not coming to your shiurim, but they may ask you questions, and you have to give them the rules of the Torah and verdict of the Torah, give them the halacha. And what we're saying now is that if the balabas doesn't walk out with clarity, that's not a good thing. You know, that's not the person you want to give smicha to. Now we get up to the word chamisim. So if you remember, Rashi had identified the word chamisim with chomsim, chamsanim. Those are like thieves, in a sense. They steal the tamaya, they withhold from you what's rightfully yours. You end up with one-fifth. The Aruch says that chamisim is lashon chatifa. Again, you would have to know more Aramaic than I know in order to appreciate this, but that's what the Bala Aruch was the expert. He was like the greatest expert in Aramaic in all of history, probably. So he says that the word chamisim in Hebrew is chatifa. Chatifa means to grab something. Right, when they talk about snacks in this country, in modern Israeli Hebrew, they talk about chatifim, you know, something that you grab and you throw it into your mouth. So they're very quick. And when you feed someone very quickly, he doesn't really understand what you're saying. You know, you have to do it slowly and digest it properly, every piece of Gemara, every piece of logic unto itself. And finally we get to Turmisim. And Rashi had identified Turmisim as Anoshim Reikonim. You know, that's you know, like an empty bag. You know, that's really harsh. The Aruch says that the word termisim is an Aramaic word, which by the way has crept into modern Hebrew, for an uga, which means a cookie. She'eno mitukenes karoi. It's an underbaked cookie. And here I think we're talking about a whole different thing. We're talking about a student who has not yet fully developed, so that he's at a young stage. You know, he hasn't yet really gotten to the point where he understands the methodology of Torah, and he can apply that methodology to new areas which he never explored. He doesn't have a methodology. He's too young for that. He's too immature. So basically, Turmisim here is a reference to a partially underbaked cookie, meaning that we should only give smicha to someone who's gotten to the point where if you let him loose, he will understand all the Torah. He has the ability. So, for example, if you want to test someone to see if he's royal smicha, give him a sugi that he never studied, and determine if, based on all the methodology he's gotten from the rest of Shas, he can apply that to this, and even though he's never seen it before, he feels comfortable and familiar with it, he's able to put it together. So it means the following: Al tismichu lanu, don't give smicha. And again, the lanu here is very interesting. You remember we had Rabbi Yonasan and Eibishitz, who said that when Rabbi Akiva conferred smicha on Rabbi Meir, it wasn't accepted by the public. We didn't like that pshat. You know, we were more excited about the pshat of Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, that it was that he himself, Rabbi Meir himself, the Nisvach, didn't accept the smicha. But the Sefer Aruch seems to indicate that why are we singing these songs? Why are we so excited about Rabbi Ami or Avasi? Because they are paradigms of people who are royal of smicha. But don't give smicha to those who confuse issues and you end up with this bochet. Don't give smicha to someone who can't put everything in its place, someone who can't explain the text properly. Don't give smicha to someone whose explanation is totally unclear. He doesn't give you tam and brurim clear. Or to those who are chotvim, they grab and they hit you with the kitchen sink without clarifying it, without slowly, painfully explaining it. What we want to do is we want to give smicha to the right person who's going to transmit Torah. And who is that? Someone who's well thought out, someone who's clear, someone who's developed, and he can present the sugya in a beautiful, complete way so that the people in the audience can understand it. they are the people who are fully bathed. They are the people who are metakin and not mekalkel. You know, they add something, they don't subtract. They give us not only the halacha, but also the understanding and the underlying reasons of the halacha. Don't give us someone who can't do a tikkun. You know, he can't clarify, and you end up with a half-baked cookie.
Arsko brings down the Yad Ramah on the Metusin, that it means lupine.
Which word are we referring to? Mitrasimim? The last of the four?
Right.
What does he say it is?
The Metusin. That Yad Ramah suggests it refers to embittered people who are as bitter as lupines, which is a variety of a bitter legume.
So it means he's sort of psychologically deficient, depressed, he's angry, he's bitter, he sort of jumps at you and stuff like that.
Yeah, usually bitter people maybe have an axe to grind, they hold a grudge.
I never personally had such a Rebbe that was bitter, but I have a friend who went to, actually it was a much more traditional yeshiva, and in our youth, at least the traditional Rosh Yeshiva that taught even on the high school level were from Europe. They spoke Yiddish, and some of them were a little bit bitter, you know, and he was kind of turned off by that. So that would reflect here this Yad Ramah to Misen. The last thing I want to read to you here is the Ofen Acher Yesh Levar Kol Elu She'enom Shonim Es HaMasechta B'Shlei Musa. There's another way that, according to the Sefer Aruch, you could explain all these negative categories. They're all people who are incomplete when it comes to Masechta. What does that mean? Sarmitim are those who cut up the Masechta into small pieces, and they only teach one part of the Masechta, like one chapter. Sarmitim are those who teach the Masechta, but they teach it to you in small pieces at a time, and they never give you the overview, you know, the wider, broader picture of the Masechta. Chamisim are those who will teach you only one-fifth of the Masechta. As we said, the Chamisim is Milashon Chomesh, one-fifth. Turmisim are those who teach you two halachos out of an entire Masechta. I mean, a very small fraction, not even a fifth. But what's common about all these is that they don't teach you the entirety. They don't give you the full Masechta. Let's go back. Rabbi Avo. Now, Rabbi Avo is the famous rabbi in Caesarea. I don't know, have you ever been to Caesarea? So Rabbi Avo was the representative of the Jewish community to Rome, and in Rome they held him in great high esteem at that particular time. And what the Gemara wants to point out is that even the non-Jewish people recognize the greatness of Rabbi Avo. Ki avi asi mi misifta lebe kesar, when he would walk out of the yeshiva on his way to the house of the Caesar, which at that time was in that area of Eretz Yisrael, that's where the Caesar was, is Nafke, who went out to sing on his behalf, Matronaisa, Debe Kesar. Matronaisa are non-Jewish women. These are women that were, so to speak, officers in the king's palace. They had a special status. And they went out to sort of greet him, Umeshairimle, and they would sing for him. Again, there's going to be a whole discussion in the Achronim here about Kol Isha. How was he able to listen to the voice, the singing voice of women? But in any event, what did they sing about him? What did they appreciate about him? And the answer is, Rabba Da'ame, he is the president, so to speak, of his people. He is the ultimate leader, the ultimate representative. Madbaranadum Nase, he's the speaker of his people. Others say it means Manig, he's the leader of his nation. Butsina de Nahora, He is a bright shining light. Brich Masyach Lishlom. And again, there are two interpretations of what this means. We're going to go through them, but first I'll give you the simple interpretation. Blessed is your coming in peace. So now let's first talk about the issue of Rabbi Avo listening to the singing voices of a woman, which is a problem because of Kol B'Isha Erva. So to understand Rabbi Avo here and how he was able to listen, you have to quote the Ritva in Kiddusha. Shmuel in Masechet Kiddushin on Daf Pei Beis is famous for saying HaKol L'Shem Shamayim. Everything you do for the sake of heaven. Says the Ritva, V'chein Hilchasa, and this is a halachic principle, DaKol Kefi Masha Odom Makir Bi'atzma. Every person has to judge himself, know thyself, as Socrates said, in a very intimate way, know myself, know exactly who I am and what I'm capable of. That's called Odom Makir V'Atzmo. And he has to decide for himself, in a very subjective way, Im Roy Lo Lasos HaRchoko LiYitzro, is the Yetzer Hara getting the best of him, and therefore he should separate himself, distance himself. V'Afilu Istakel B'Bigdei Isha, he shouldn't even be looking at the clothes of a woman. Now, I'm not sure if he's talking about women's clothes that are being worn by a woman, that's a big problem, but even maybe women's clothes that are hanging on the mannequins, you know, in the show places, he should be marking himself. Why? Because he realizes the HR quickly gets a hold of him. However, in Makir B'Atzmo, says the Ritva, Yitzro Nichna V'Kofruflo, if he recognizes that he is able to overcome and subjugate his Yitzhar, the ain malatina klal, and he doesn't get aroused at all. Mutalo listakel uledaber ma'erva. He's allowed to look at a woman and speak to her. The lishol bishloma. He can even ask how she's doing, even if she's a married woman, because he's not going to be tempted. Vahainu, and I'll give you an example. Hahi de Rabbi Yochanan. The Gemara tells us about Metzia, about Rabbi Yochanan, the Yosef Ashari Tvila. He used to actually sit himself on the outside of the mikvah. I mean, today we know, if you follow the news the last couple of years, you know, the mikvah is a very tempting kind of thing. But Rabbi Yochanan sat himself in front of the mikvah. The Ritva doesn't quote the details. He just says, Lo Chai Sheyetzahara, he didn't have bad thoughts about the woman who was going to the mikvah. But the reason why he sat there, I think the Gemara is in Brachos, if I'm not mistaken. The Gemara says because the women would see Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was enormously gorgeous, and they would have beautiful children. For Rabbi Ami, the Gemara tells about Rabbi Ami in Masechta Ksubis, the Nafki Am Hasa Debe Kisar, that he would go out even meeting the mother of the Kesar. The Kama. There were many chachamim that felt that they could talk to these women who were sarot, you know, they were in the court. And Gemara tells us about, I mean, he says it's Rav Adam Barav, I thought it was a Bishum and Levi, I get confused here, that Nokin HaKala Ktife, he used to actually take, at a wedding, he would take the Kala, and he would put a piggyback on his shoulders, v'rakidba, and he would dance while she was on his shoulders. V'lochayish leheruhura, and he had no suspicion of having the wrong thoughts.
That's what he
did. What did he say? You saw somebody like that?
Rav Shlomo Karlitz,
he should have pointed to this Ritva, maybe he did, because the Ritva goes through the whole thing. Everything I'm quoting to you is from the Ritva, one of the Rishonim.
I don't understand.
Let me just finish the Ritva. He says, Ella, here's the, you know, the cutoff point. Ain Roy Lahakil was there, even though we see that the Chachamim did such a thing, and they were lenient, permitting themselves, but Ain Roy, it's not fitting to be make El Chassid Gadol. Only someone who is a great Chassid. Again, this is before the Baal Shem. We're not talking about the Chassidim. When he's talking about Chassid Gadol, you know, someone who's pious, if you read the Mesil Sishar, you'll see how many steps you have to get to until you can reach Chassidus. And not only that, he's got to be makir b'yitzro. He has to know exactly how capable his yitzro is. V'ein kol chak talmid chachamim botchim v'yitzrayim. And not every talmid chacham can be absolutely sure that he has control over his yitzer. Ashrei misha gover al yitzro. However, he ends with a bracha. He says, I praise those who are able to overcome the yitzer. V'amolo uv'mnosa v'atorah, and they're able to put all their efforts and all their expertise in mind and body into the study of Torah without being distracted by what they see or what they saw. Shedivrei Torah omdim lo. In such a case, if the Yetzer Hara is not getting the best of him, then his Torah study will remain with him. Li'odah bi'alduso v'nosnim lo. Achris v'tikfo li'esik noso. Shenemar odin v'un v'seva d'shenivran and in you. He gives you a blessing if you're on that level. Yeah.
The lashon of the Gemara is not in the Rabot, right? It's not Kalisha, it's Nashim. So, there's no...
Maybe there are two women singing simultaneously.
Right. So you don't have a problem with Kalisha.
Right, so the thing is like this. The Gemara seems to differentiate between one kol and two kolos in the case of something that's chaviv lo, which means if, let's say, two people are reading the Megillah, so then... that's the opposite. They were saying that he's going to hear one voice and not the other because he could discern one voice. But the implication is that if he's interested in hearing something, then he will differentiate between one voice and the other. So usually, the reason why those who are making it with two women is because of trei koli lo mishtamoi, that you don't hear two voices. And you can't differentiate one from the other. No, it's the whole idea of kolish is when you relate that kol to a specific woman. But in the case of chaviv lo, in the case where he really is interested in hearing what she's singing, then I would think even in two women it's a problem. But in any event, there are different ways of going here. Obviously, one way is to say that he wasn't benefiting from their songs; they were singing. You know, he was probably a little distracted. There's a famous story about Rabbi Zalman Meltzer that he was once coming home a little bit earlier than he used to, and the maid was upstairs, and when he opened the door, he heard her singing. Or maybe he didn't even open the door. Maybe even before he opened the door, he heard her singing. So he stayed outside until she finished singing because he didn't want to interrupt her song. He knew that if she saw him in the building, in the house, she would immediately stop her singing. So he didn't want to derive her that pleasure of singing. So he remained outside. Now, a lot of these terms that are used here by the Matronusa de Bekesar to sing for Rabbi Avoh have become part of our lingo. I'll give you an example. Rav Avadia Yosef, when he gives an introduction to a book, an appellation, you know, when you write a haskama, so he uses a lot of these terms. It's really fascinating that they come from the Matronisa de Bekesa. For example, he says, the girl said, Madbarana de Umse. So what's Madbarana de Umse? So we said it's the leader of the nation. Now, why is Rabbi Avoh considered the leader of the nation? He's the Parnas. He's in charge of divvying up all the community chest, whatever monies can be divvied up amongst the poor people, etc. But Karav Lamalchus, and he always had the ears of the Kesar. So that was his special status. So the Marsha says about Rabbi Avoh that he had two different dimensions. He says he was on the one hand Rabba di Ame, and on the other hand he was Madbarana di Umse. Rabba di Ame, the Rav of his people, that is a reflection on the Torah that he transmitted to the entire nation. He was the Golo B'Torah in his time. Madbarana di Umse reflects the fact that he was Karav L'Malchus, that he had tremendous political influence in the higher echelons. Then we get to Botsina Dinahora, which is a very powerful, illuminating, radiating light. And it's interesting that Rashi identifies this light with his physical beauty. He was very handsome. He was a Gadol Biyofi. And that's why they sang for him this song of Butzina Dinahora. And the Gemara in Bava Metzia compares the beauty of Rabbi Avoh to the beauty of Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu apparently was very, very handsome. Again, this is this much deeper meaning here. I'm just giving you two on the surface level. Now, in terms of the bracha that they bestowed upon Rabbi Avoh, so there are two interpretations. Brich Masyach Lishlom. So the Yad Ramah offers two interpretations. His first interpretation is that they gave him a bracha and they say Baruch Mishav Yiratzon Shev Bacha L'Sholom. You know, a bracha is really a blessing. A bracha is really a prayer. So they prayed on his behalf that everything should go well in peace, especially since he was representing the downtrodden Jewish people to the highfalutin, powerful Rome, so the Roman Caesar, so they gave him that blessing because they were so enamored with him. The second shot that the Yad Ramah offers is that Baruch Mishaheviachol Shalom, they were really blessing the Almighty. They were so impressed by this person that it aroused them to bless the Almighty God who brought this person Bishalom peacefully and brought him to us. Which I find fascinating, just my own comment, because you know there's a concept called Marobu Masecha. So if you go out to the Swiss Alps, you know, and you say, wow, how beautiful God's nature is. What about when I see a beautiful person or the accomplishments of a person, the greatness of a person? You know, I meet an Albert Einstein, right? So I also make a bracha. I'm thanking Hashem. So it's interesting because sometimes people think, you know, when I see God's world, then I appreciate God and I bless God and I thank God. But when I see man, so I attribute all his achievements to him, and I'm a little bit disconnected from God. But that's not what the Gemara is saying here, according to the Yad Ramah. This great man came to our midst. Blessed is God who peacefully brought this man into our midst. And I think that's a lesson for life, that whenever we see something in a human being and we're inspired by a person, then we should already automatically thank Hashem, because this is a creation of God. You know, there's a whole issue in halacha, it's also in Ashkafa, whether we should visit museums and appreciate, you know, art and so forth and so on. What it may depend upon this, you know. If you're seeing a Rembrandt and you're saying, "Wow, Rembrandt must have been great," you know, that's not the key of keys here. From a Jewish perspective, you see Rembrandt, you see that God created a Rembrandt, or you study, you know, the contributions of mathematicians and scientists and the research that's leading to unbelievable cures for so many diseases and so forth. You know, you appreciate man's genius, you know, like I said before, the Albert Einstein, and you say, wow, God created such a thing. So in the achievements of man, you see the greatness of God and you appreciate God. Now we're about to start a different part of the Mishnah, and I think it's not coincidental that this falls in this week, because which parasha are we reading this week? Shoftim. And Shoftim has the parasha of Egla Rufa. And the Mishnah records machlokes about how many chachamim have to be there for the Arifas HaEgla. What does it mean? We found a slain body between two cities. And what's required, says the Torah, is that we do a medida. Medida means we have to measure from the body to the two nearest cities and see what is the nearest city. What is the closest city? And the Chachamim have to supervise this process called medida. How many Chachamim have to be there? And we'll see that these Chacham are actually members of the High Court of Israel, the Sanhedrin Agdola. So according to the Mishnah, there's a debate here between Rabbi Shimon, who says Shlosha, and Rabbi Yehuda requires five. And our whole sugya is trying to analyze how this machlokas came about. Now, Tosus says that this entire sugya that we're learning is not about the actual arifas ha'egla, which means that after they finish the process and the chachamim come down to this nachal and they recite what they have to recite, then they basically break the head of the egla, of this calf. He says that the breaking of the neck of the calf, that part of the ritual, is done. Just let me read it again. Ein kavod gzel arifas egla mamish me'achas zikne ira krovel chol heim heim orfim. He says that it's not Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin sat in Yerushalayim. The arifas egla was done by the local zakenim who resided in the closest city to the slain person, to the nirtzach. The machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon recorded in that Mishnah is about how many members of Sanhedrin have to come down from Yerushalayim. That's not for the purpose of arifas ha'egla, which is done, as we said before, by the locals Canaan. But the purpose is limedidas ha'orim. So it's the members of Sanhedrin who come down from Yerushalayim. They're going to determine which is the closest city. They're going to implement the medida, the measurements. And which is the city that's closest? Smucha l'chalal. Chalal and chalal means the dead, the corpse. And that's an obligation of medida that is incumbent upon the Ziknei Sanhedrin. As it says in the Pasuk, which we'll read in Mirsem the Shabbos, V'yetzu zkeinecha v'shoftecha u'madadu es ha'orim asher svivos ha'chalal. So v'yatzu means they leave Yerushalayim from the Beis Din HaGadol that sat outside the Beis HaMikdash. And how many had to leave? It was either three according to Rav Shimon or five according to Rav Yehuda. And they're going to determine which city is the closest city. Tana Rabbana. So this Braisa is going to give us a little bit of an insight to this machlokas between Rav Shimon and Rav Yehuda. The first part of the Braisa reflects the sheet of Rav Yehuda. The Pasuk says in the parash of Egla Rufa, V'yatzu zekeinecha v'shoftecha. I'll read the end of the Pasuk, which is not quoted here in the Gemara. U'madadu es ha'orim asher svivos ha'chalol. So it says V'yatzu, and then it says keinecha in the plural and shoftecha in the plural. So Rabbi Yehuda says keinecha, since it's in the plural, what's the minimum number for a plural?
Two.
And then it says Shoftecha, that's the minimum number in plural, is two. Is then we end up with four. But Rabbi Yehuda says you need five members of the Sanhedrin. Why? The Ein Osin She'ein Bezdin Shakel. We never make a Bezdin that is made up of an even number. Now here the Mefarshim, starting with the Yad Ramayim down, have a hard time with this Gemara, because the reason why you need a Bezdin Nota, you can't have a Bezdin Shuffle, is in case there's a division, a controversy, a debate amongst the Chachamim, so we need a majority to rule. And it shouldn't be a take, you know, a split 50-50. But here in the case of Medida is an actual measurement. And that's objective. I mean, there shouldn't be any debate about it that you should need a majority rules kind of thing. So the Yad Ramah, you know what I'm talking about? Like in football, you know, you want to know, let's say, where they got a new down? What's it called?
First down.
I'm a little bit rusty. So you need 10 yards, right? So they come out with that stick. What is it called? Does it have a name? That, you know, and they measure it.
Measuring
from where the previous down was and now this down. So there's not going to be a controversy on it. You put the thing down and you measure it. So the Yad Ramah says there will be a machlokas. What is the machlokas? There are various organs in the body And these organs, unfortunately, were destroyed, you know, were harmed and injured by the murderer. And the question is, where is the death, so to speak? Did he die from this aver, from that aver? And the medida has to be so precise, because the slain body, the corpse, was located between two equidistant between two cities. It could be a fraction of a difference. So let's say certain chachamim on of these zikney ha'eder will decide that it's from the head. We should calculate from the head, and others say no, we should calculate from the heart, and so forth and so on. The abdomen, I don't know. You can see where the body was slain
or where he fell, yeah.
And you can decide from what part of the body. So the Yad Ramah says that there's an entire sugya in Masechta Sota. Masechta Sota is dedicated to two major themes or subjects. I mean, there are other subjects, but the two most primary subjects are, number one, a Sota, and number two, Egla Rufa. And in the sugya of Egla Rufa, in Sota Memhei, there's a Machlokas Tanoim, from which aver of the body you should calculate the medida. So we need a bezdin noter, an odd number. So you have two and two, that's keinecha and shoftecha, and now you have to add a fifth. Is mosifin aleim od harekan chamisha divrei Rav Yehuda. Rav Shimon omer keinecha. I agree with you that keinecha is in the plural, and therefore we need two judges. I don't agree with you that shoftecha is going to teach you two judges. So I end up with just two judges from Skenecha. I don't have the other two judges of Shoftecha. But Ein Bezdin Shakul is Mosifin Aleim Odech Arekan Shlosha. So according to Rav Shimon, we need to get this odd number, and therefore we had a third judge, Arekan Shlosha. So the Gemara immediately asks, on this Brisa, on this Rav Shimon, is Hai Shoftecha my ovenly? Well, he must use Shoftecha for something else, and therefore he doesn't use it to jack up the number of judges by two extra judges. What this means is that we need the highest stature status of Shoftecha. They're not going to be members of the lower courts, not even of the Sanhedrin of Ketana, which has 23 judges, and they can do they can even judge a capital case. But we need miuchadim shebishoftecha, means from the Sanhedrin Agdola that's made up of 71 elders. Okay. Rabbi Yehuda. After all, Rabbi Yehuda uses the shoftecha to derive the number of skenim that we need, and he jacks it up by another two. So how is he going to learn that these judges have to come from the Sanhedrin Agdola? And he said, and the Gemara answers that Rabbi Yehuda has a gzeirah shavah. What gzeirah shavah did he have? Miziknez keinecha nafka. No, I'm sorry. I said it was a gzeirah shavah. Later on, we're going to have a gzeirah. This is not about a gzeirah shavah. Sorry. This is about the extra chaf of the word. Which word? Of the word zkeinecha. You see, it says v'yatzu zkeinecha. It could have said v'yatzu zikne shoftecha. Why did it say zkeinecha? So there's an extra chaf, and the extra chaf teaches me that it has to be hamiuchadim shebezkeinim, which means members of the high court of the Sanhedrin Agdol. So this sugya of Egla Ruf is another example of what we spoke about yesterday, that sometimes part of the Bezdin breaks off, so to speak, as the agents on behalf of the entire Bezdin to achieve something. And we spoke about, if you remember, Smichus on the Parhelim Dovashel Tzibur, that we have a number of judges that come from the Bezdin Agadol, and they actually do the Smicha. And they're representatives of the entire Bezdin. So certain things can be efficiently done and accomplished by not requiring the entire body of the Sanhedrin, every last body on the Sanhedrin, but rather a representation. So how many judges do we require? Comes along Rabbi Yehuda, and he says, Keinecha is two. Shoftecha is another two. And then we add the fifth. Why doesn't he need the Shoftecha to teach me that these are judges that sit on the highest court of Israel, the Sanhedrin HaGdolah? The answer is that he derives from the extra chaf of the words Kenecha. So the word Shoftecha now becomes totally free or superfluous to derive from it another two judges. The Gemara is so convinced by the logic of Rabbi Yehuda that the Gemara now turns the table on Rabbi Shimon and asks the following question. Rabbi Shimon, why does he need the word Shoftecha to teach me Miuchadim Shem Shoftecha? Why can't he learn it from the Chaf of Zkenecha the way Rabbi Yehuda did? And he answers, Imi Ziknei, if the Torah had just said V'yatsu Ziknei, the elders of the community, then Hava Mina, I would have thought it means Ziknei Ashuk. Kasa Rabbahon Zkenecha, the Torah adds the Chaf of Zkenecha to jack it up one level, one notch. The Ik Siv, if it would have said V'yatsu Zkenecha with the extra Chaf, without the word V'shoftayev, V'shoftecha, then I would have jacked it up one level. From Zkenei Ziknei Ashuk, is I would have assumed that it's Sanhedrin HaGdolah. So Ziknei Ashuk represent the normal monetary court made up of three judges. But now that the Torah says Zkenecha, so the Torah, by adding the chaf at the end of the words Ziknei, is telling me that it's not just members of the basic court, the bottom level court of three judges, but rather it's an upgraded Zkenecha. And if we go up one level from the court of three judges, what's the next level? Sanhedrin HaGdolah. That's from the court of 23 judges. Okay, so now I need Shoftecha. And Shoftecha, Kosrachman of Shoftecha, Miyuchadim Shev Shoftecha, means we got to jack it up another notch from the Sanhedrin Akhtana to the Sanhedrin Akhdola, from the Sanhedrin 23 to the Sanhedrin of 71. But therefore, the word Shoftecha is not superfluous, it's not free to derive another two judges. So that's the Shita of Rabbi Shimon. Okay, we're about halfway through this sugya, but we'll finish this up tomorrow. We'll start at 8 o'clock and we'll finish at about 8:45, something like 8:50, maybe 8:45, and that's what we have. Now I do give an Iyun Shin Sanhedrin, but I'm going to start that program next week. No, we're still on Bein Hazmanim for the Iyun Shir in Sanhedrin, which I think is going to be on, probably end up on either Mondays and Tuesdays or Tuesdays and Wednesdays. We're still trying to figure out. Quite a number of our members are in Chutzarts now, and even Jerry has to go. To not Chutzarts, but he has to take care of a few things for the next 10 days. And Steve is not here.
Steve's in Chicago.
Steve is in Chicago. I'm not sure about Don, but Don maybe has an exam today.
Where's Asher?
Asher is also in Chutzlars. I don't know when he's coming back. And Jeff Secunda's in Chutzlars. He's not part of this year. He's part of like next year. A lot of the Chefer are in Chutzlars.
About the
mace,
does the mace have to be a Jewish mace?
Yes.
And is it whether male or female? Only male?
Male or female.
Right.
Now I'm going to give a shiur tomorrow, Bali Neder, if anyone's interested, on the message of Egla Rufa. What's the philosophical Ashkafic message that we should take for our own lives? We don't have Egla Rufa today. We don't have the requirements that are necessary, but we should be learning. There's a sefer called Derech Pikudeh from one of the rebbes of Chabad. And his thesis is that every mitzvah, even if it's not no heges b'zman, is that we have to learn at least the message that's inherent in the mitzvah. So what's the message in Egla Rufa?
When is that shir?
So that shir I give at 3:15. And if you're not in this room, I give it in my house, which is about a 6-minute walk from here. Now that's on Rabbi Meir number 3. So if you guys want to join me for that, I would love it.
Still in Har Nof?
Well, I live in Har Nof at night, but during the day I'm here. Wow. So, and Shabbos I'm here, so we have a place about 6 minutes
walk. I your home. I thought you only
Yeshirim. Well, only this one is a Skype shift to Toronto, and it's much easier for me to do it after I eat lunch and after I rest a little bit. So it's 8:15 on their clock. That's when they walk out of the first minion in Clanton Park in Toronto. So that's when they get together. I've been keeping this Skype share going for almost a decade, man.
Wow.
So I usually get anywhere between 3 and 7 guys. You know.
I'm going to try 7:30 for the Musar.
Mitzvah.
The whole concept is it's really that you're supposed to love.
Oh, you know what? What would you prefer, David? Because I can give in Toronto something else. Is it easier for you if I give the Egla Roof on tonight?
I'm here no matter what.
No, what I mean to say is if I
wouldn't come tomorrow at midnight.
Oh, you probably wouldn't come tomorrow at 3:15. So then, you know what, maybe I'll give the Egla Roof for tomorrow and I'll think of another topic for I'll give the Egla Roof for tonight.
Okay.
Oh, that's at 8:30. Oh, so that's not relevant to you. So then, back to square one. Okay.
It's all right.
I give 7:30. I give my Peleoates here, and that's going to change. I'm thinking of a sefer called the Meshech Chachma. If you heard of it, and then at 8:30.
It's Chomish.
8:30 is Chomish. Maybe at 8:30 I'll give either Egla Rufo or I'll talk about the mitzvah that's incumbent on a melech to write 2 Sifrei Torah.
Amara?
And Amara is at 9:30.